Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
It's what we do.
Here's John Williams.
I like to think of myself as a stable genius, but you may disagree. It's 107. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. The sun is shining. It looks and feels like a summer day. Has 30-plus degrees ever felt better? Wow. You know, over the weekend, we got above 20 degrees for the first time since Christmas Day. When I heard that on this very radio station over the weekend, I thought, yeah, that's about right. Wow. And now, in this studio where I sit, it is currently 89 degrees. And this is what happens to household furnaces and air conditioning systems, especially if you have the old radiated heat. But, you know, the system somewhere in a building is cranked up to fight 20 degrees, 18 degrees, and now it's double that, and the furnace keeps cranking. And so suddenly you've got a home much warmer, an office building, a school, a classroom, much warmer than you want. That's where I'm sitting right now. But enough about me. I thought we would be spending more time today talking, at least I felt this way, say, Sunday at noon, about the Jake Tapper interview on CNN over the weekend of presidential advisor Stephen Miller. They got into an argument, and at one point Stephen Miller said that Donald Trump is a genius. He said that he is able to take information on Air Force One and 20 minutes later turn it around in a speech that the president might give. I've heard the president speak many times, and the word that comes to my mind is not genius when I hear him speak. But we did hear something pretty extraordinary last night. I don't know if you like Oprah. I don't know if you don't like Oprah. I don't know if you want her to be president or you don't want her to be president. But what you heard last night was a great 9-minute oration that was and will be one of the better delivered speeches, one of the better thought out, better written, better delivered, better timely speeches you will ever hear. She simply nodded to the crowd and then she started, at first talking about her mom and, of all people, Sidney Poitier. Here's cut number one.
In 1964, I was a little girl sitting on the linoleum floor of my mother's house in Milwaukee, watching Anne Bancroft present the Oscar for Best Actor at the 36th Academy Awards. She opened the envelope and said five words that literally made history. The winner is Sidney Poitier. Up to the stage came the most elegant man I had ever seen. I remember his tie was white, and of course his skin was black, and I'd never seen a black man being celebrated like that. And I have tried many, many, many times to explain what a moment like that means to a little girl, a kid watching from the cheap seats, as my mom came through the door, bone-tired, from cleaning other people's houses. But all I can do is quote and say that the explanation in Sidney's performance in Lilies of the Field, amen, 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 amen. In 1982, Sidney received the Cecil B. DeMille Award right here at the Golden Globes, and it is not lost on me that at this moment, there are some little girls watching as I become the first black woman to be given the same award.
The camera work was really good last night, because as she was delivering that speech, and I've got to get a pair of glasses like that. You look so much smarter when you have the when you have the thick plastic rim glasses. It works if you're a movie star. It works if you're the Cubs coach. Everybody's rocking those thick black plastic glasses these days. I've got to get me a pair of those. But they kept cutting to the people in the crowd, and granted, that was her audience, that was her crowd, but they were rapt. They were so appreciative, not only, I think, of what she was saying, but just how thoughtfully, how well she was saying it.
I'm not a big Oprah fan.
by any means.
I'm much more than you.
Yeah. And it was a speech for the moment.
It really was. Or would you say the ages? I mean, I just really thought it was extraordinary. I mean, in that moment, I guess, is really what you're saying. But, you know, the speech was sort of amplified by the moment that she was in. If Hollywood had not been all amped up these days on this hashtag Me Too movement, it still would have been a great speech. But that sure did amplify its
impact.
Its impact. Thank you, Steve. Me talk good.
I'm going to help you because I know what it's like down there.
It is a little warm. Okay, so then she talked about a little bit more about the Golden Globes. This is the next part of Oprah's speech.
I'd like to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, because we all know that the press is under siege these days. But we also know that it is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice. To tyrants and victims and secrets and lies. I want to say that I value the press more than ever before as we try to navigate these complicated times, which brings me to this. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories.
And then Oprah commented on somebody I had not heard about before, Recy Taylor. Did you know who Recy Taylor was? Had you heard that name before? You'd heard of Rosa Parks. This is the Recy Taylor story.
And there's someone else, Recy Taylor. A name I know and I think you should know too. In 1944, Recy Taylor was a young wife and a mother. She was just walking home from a church service. She'd attended in Abbeville, Alabama, when she was abducted by six armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice. But justice wasn't an option in the era of Jim Crow. The men who tried to destroy her were never persecuted. Recy Taylor died 10 days ago, just shy of her 98th birthday. She lived, as we all have lived, too many years in a culture broken by brutally powerful men. For too long, women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their truth to the power of those men. But their time is up.
Yeah. Not bad. I don't know if she was using a teleprompter. She didn't have note cards in her hand. There must have been a teleprompter there. But it was just a well-written and well-delivered speech. And again, the reactions to the crowd with each chapter of that story that she was telling. First, the Sidney Poitier and her mom, and then the shout-out to the press and the importance of it when you feel like you're fighting tyranny or untruths. And then the Recy Taylor story. And then she gets to chapter four. This is when she announces that she wants to be president of the United States.
I've interviewed and portrayed people who withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you. But the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say, me too, again.
And then they roared. And then the timing, the juxtaposition was funny, I thought. And the next person to come out after her speech is Opie, is Ron Howard. If anybody ever seemed to be, I don't know, a little more visual or mental whiplash than that speech in Oprah Winfrey, it's then Ron Howard coming up. And he just goes, well, wow. And then he, you know, did what he had to do as well. It was all fine, but it's just struck me as almost comical, the sort of transition from her and that to him. In fact, a lot of the guys who they would catch on camera, particularly when they were nominated for an award or they won an award, were almost sheepish about it last night. They're almost like, well, I hate to be a guy tonight. When Natalie Portman said, and the nominees all male are, I thought that was a cheap shot because none of those guys did anything to not deserve the nomination they were up for.
I'm so glad you brought that up because that was, to me, the only bad note of the night.
Totally. Totally agree.
It was gratuitous. And
right.
I hope she's thinking about it today because it was absolutely unfair to the people who won the nominations.
Men are not the problem. Bad men are the problem. And I get what last night was about. I'm not here to speak about that really today. But I just thought some of the reaction shots to some of the guys, they were like, oh, sorry. You know, literally, they were almost hiding their heads when they said, and the nominees are. And then they cut to all these guys. God forbid you're a white guy about, oh, a certain age, because they looked as if they didn't want to be nominated last night. I guess that's understandable. Back to Oprah's speech. So on Facebook, I'm King John on Facebook, and I just put this up as just before we ran down the hall to the studio. We've already got 50 comments on it, so maybe you'll be one of them too. I'm asking you this question. If it was Oprah Winfrey versus the incumbent, and today is 2020 November, would you vote for Oprah Winfrey? That's one way to put it. Another would be, do you want her to run? My answer to that is no. I've always said Oprah should run. I always thought she's smart enough, she's powerful enough, she's liked enough. They don't have to develop her brand. Everybody knows who Oprah is, blah, blah, blah. You know, good and bad, at least you got that going for you. And so I would always say Oprah should run for president. And then with Jesse Ventura or Donald Trump run and won, then you say, well, see, Oprah could do it too. Now Oprah is actually thinking about running for president. That's what we're hearing. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, no, let's not do that. Can't we just get somebody who was a congressman and then they were a governor and it was an industrial state?
You mean someone who understands how government works?
Kind of. I mean, I don't know how much of that you do have to know, really. I mean, evidently, you don't really have to know how government works to, A, be president, or maybe even, B, be a pretty good president. You'll get people to figure that out, and how much damage can you do? I mean, literally, could Oprah be any better or worse than the president we've got now? So you may, all of those considerations you would have about her rookiness can be thrown out the window now because Donald Trump seems to be able to get along. I'm thinking of Jesse Ventura. He was able to get along. I mean, Ventura didn't run again, and we don't know what's going to happen to this term. Would Trump run again? Would he win? But obviously, you can do it. And if you think she's as smart or smarter than he is, if you think she has more empathy than he does, if you think she's less cuckoo bananas than he is, then, hey, what the hey? Listen, that end of that speech last night sounded like Reagan and Barack Obama. The dawn. She used the word dawn. I don't think that's a word that you just drop in there without thinking of its resonance. But didn't that sound a little like Barack Obama on the stump meets Ronald Reagan to you? I thought it sounded a lot like that. And that was just a speech last night. Then today they go, see, I told you she's going to run. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's what she was writing for.
Mm.
She was writing for the campaign.
No,
she wasn't
way.
Writing for the Golden Globes.
I don't agree.
I think that's what she was doing last night.
She's too smart to run. She knows she's not qualified. We're dealing right now with a celebrity who, you know, came in with limited traditional qualifications. I think she's smart enough to realize that's not the case.
Wow. Here's your chance to call, 312-981-7200. You can respond to the question on my Facebook page, would you vote for, or any other observations you had about that night last night. You can text to that same number, too, but I want to hear from you right now, 312-981-7200. Line two is Jim. Jim, you're on WGN. How are you? Hi.
Good. All I want to say is, with Oprah, I was copycat.
Yeah, you got to say more than that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, she's like, if Donald Trump can do it. And she, by the way, there's a video out there that she interviewed him some 30 years ago, back in 1988, running for president, when he, with his responses and so forth.
And how does that reflect?
Like, she just wants to be a copycat.
Yeah. I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Yeah, have a good day. I think that's how people might read that, too. Frankly, that's the... I think that would be very problematic. Oh, you had a celebrity television host? Well, then we'll get one, too. Too bad, or never mind that she might be good at it, or I don't know what qualified is, but I'll say qualified. But now you don't want to fight that fire with that fire. You know, you want to do something else. I don't know what something else is, but...
Michael Jordan.
Michael... yeah. No, who else? You know, heck, if we're going to go there, yeah. Well, The Rock, is The Rock going to run as a Democrat, or would he be a Republican? I presume he'd be a Democrat, right? Who's next there, Elif? Karen is on line 3, is that right? Okay, hi, Karen, you're on WGN. Hello.
Hi, John. I think you misinterpreted Natalie Portman's comment and was a little chauvinistic of you. She meant there weren't any female directors. Not she, you know, she had not, she wasn't saying anything bad about the men nominated.
No,
she was that there weren't any female directors, not enough of them.
Well, but it was the director category, and she said and the all male nominees are, right?
And she said
and
no.
What she meant was there weren't any female directors. She wasn't throwing them under the carpet. You were wrong. When you're wrong, admit it, John. Come on.
Yeah, well, I will if I think I am or if I'm proven to be. But
well, let me speak if I can, because I'm part of that. And she said the nominees are, and then she threw in there all men.
Right.
And you're right. Her point was that there were no women nominated. That's absolutely
That's right.
That's exactly
absolutely.
Her point. But I think the point John was trying to make, and certainly the point I was trying to make, was that it had that wasn't the fault of the five men who were nominated that night and were about to have their name read for an award that they may well have earned.
Right, that tends to...
I didn't see their faces the way you saw them.
Well, there's
them.
Only so many slots. That delegitimizes the guys who are there. It's like, okay, here's five guys, all men, and the subtext is none of them are women. A woman should be there.
And it was all about women. There were no women nominated.
Well, it's about talent and who deserves the award.
That's the point.
Anything bad about the men. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think you're wrong.
I think the implication was that there should have been a couple of women in there. And if there were, then a couple of those men didn't belong.
And you took it further, and you were saying that she said something about the men. She wasn't saying anything about the guys nominated.
Thank you for the phone call.
Maybe you need to admit you're wrong sometimes, John.
I will just as soon as I think I am. But on this one, I think I'm just taking it to the next step. I don't think that statement exists in a vacuum. I mean...
if they earned it, those slots, they deserve to be nominated,
right,
the men.
Right, right.
And if it's all men, that just...
I mean, I don't know how she would have said it, because it was pretty impactful the way she did. But if she said something like, and too bad there aren't three other women on, we didn't nominate eight because it's deserving. And now that sentence has lost its punch, hasn't it?
Well, she just shouldn't have, you know, I just think it was the wrong time to say something.
Hit it.
And here are the all-male nominees.
Right, and if we're talking about equality, the men have an equal chance of doing a good job as the women do.
What she said. Who's on line 3 there, Elif? Tom is on line 3. You're on... oops, sorry. Tom's on line 4, I guess, right? Hey, Tom, you're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon. I wanted to comment on Oprah. I think it was Noah Rotman from Commentary Magazine on Twitter today envisioned a scenario where you have a celebrity and a slate of 16 seasoned politicians, and just like what happened in the Republican primary, the way the primaries are set up, the celebrity can hijack the primary, and next thing you know, you've got a celebrity that gets the nomination. And, you know, certainly with Trump, he's certainly unqualified. I didn't vote for either candidate last time. So while Trump was certainly... proven himself to be unqualified, I think I wouldn't vote for Oprah either, but at least she's got more brains. She could probably put things together better than Trump.
Thanks for the phone call. You know, if you think about it, he's right. If you just think, don't think about him beating Trump, her beating Trump, just think about her winning the Democratic nomination. Is she more attractive than Bernie Sanders? Yes. Is she more attractive than Joe Biden? Yes. Well, one list this week had them as the one and two for Democrats in 2020 right now. Cory Booker's in the top five.
I think the appetite for giving an outsider a chance has been sated for a while. I do. I just don't think that you'll see that the next time.
Well, almost too bad for her then, because you don't think she would be a competent or an all-encompassing, a more embracing president? You don't think that she could reach across the aisle? I mean, that's really what we're going to need.
Well, she certainly had great experience in, she has the social awareness of a minority situation and overcoming that or growing through that.
Well, she's got to embrace Republicans, conservatives.
Well, I know, but she has built a business from the ground up.
Nobody gave her $1 million to start.
$100 million. So she has all that, but that doesn't mean that you have the qualifications to be president. Maybe she would, but she'd have to go through, you'd have to see through the campaign, I guess.
Except for experience. She has all the qualifications.
Except for experience.
Well, okay, but I mean, intelligence, intuition, a good emotional IQ. Been on the planet long enough to know a horse when you see one, which is a new saying, by the way.
Most of what we know about her, we're making up in our own minds right now, because she hasn't been through what politicians running for high office have been gone through.
I think we know a lot about Oprah.
Well, she might give us all each cars, so there's that.
You know, when she was doing that very end where she says, "And we will not take it anymore," and whenever she does there, 300 million people go, "You get a car, you get a car, you get a car." She's going to have to work on her pitch. You know, my problem with all the money in the world.
Right.
Was that there is a book about Doris Duke called The Richest Little Girl, they had to compress so much that you had a million questions, right? Like, well, where were the police, or where was the press, or where was the other family members? If J. Paul Getty, the billionaire, the richest man in the world, wouldn't give 17, 14, 7, 4, the number kept going down, $1 million to bail out his son from kidnappers, where was everybody else who could have helped that child's mother, who in fact did not have any money?
His grandson, right?
Yeah, his grandson.
Right.
And remember, the kidnappers sent the boy's ear to the police, and Getty finally found out about that, and eventually he did put some money up. But you just had so many questions about how this story could have happened. Boy, in this day and age, I don't think it would happen like that.
Now, have you seen Three Billboards?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is the best movie of the year.
You just told me Get Out was the best movie of the year.
It is. Get Out is the best movie of the year. Those are the two best movie of the year.
I got to, and not the Shape of Water.
Not the Shape of Water. Those other two.
Okay.
Those other two. It's 1:41. Before we go to the CEO of MoviePass, Jen's been holding, and she wanted to say something about Natalie Portman's snarky comment at the Golden Globes last night. Hey, Jen, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
What's your thought? What's your question?
So, first of all, I felt terrible for those male nominees, because I don't believe her comment was directed towards them, and I don't believe that she was implying that they didn't deserve those awards. I feel that her comment was directed to the industry. There aren't enough women directors being hired, or we would have seen women as the nominee. Because what are the odds you're going to have five male nominees if you have 50% women directors and 50% male directors?
I think that was exactly her point. It just shouldn't have been delivered there the way she did it.
Boy. Yeah, and I everybody has their own filter. I don't know how all those men who were nominated felt. Like, did they feel slighted as though, well, of course, we're up here because it's skewed toward the guys, but we're not as deserving as some women? And that's the way I heard it, that one of them or two of them shouldn't be up there because we only nominate men. And
maybe they shouldn't be up there. Maybe if women were more represented in the directing field, those men would not be up there, because there are women who are better than them.
Well, you started by saying you felt bad for those five men.
Oh, I totally did, because, I mean, it really put them on the spot, because she was criticizing the fact that they are all men, and they can't help the fact that they're men, and the system is set up so so that they do have more of an advantage.
Sure, they're the beneficiaries of those unfair circumstances, but you're not. But it's quite possible that, in fact, of the field, they were the five most deserving. It's just we don't give more women a chance to even get in the game, right?
That's how I saw it.
I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for listening. Okay, so here it is. Natalie Portman, one more time last night. Oh, you don't have it? We don't have it ready. Okay. It's 140. You do? Okay, hit it now.
We are honored to be here to present the award for Best Director.
And here are the all-male nominees.
Then they just milked it. Ooh. And that was right after Oprah's speech. It's
and
a 140.
Guillermo del Toro was there, and he just kind of shrugged, right? I mean, they cut to him.
Yeah, actually, they did, now that you mentioned.
And he's like, well, you know,
what am I going to do?
I'm about to win this. I'm
Honey,
sorry.
You go up and get it, because I don't think this is my room right now.
All right, on Saturday, I said we would do this at 135, and we're going to do it in this segment between now and 2 o'clock, and here it comes. Although, just so you know, this is a conversation that we had on Saturday's show. Mitch Lowe, the CEO of MoviePass, was available to us on my Saturday morning show here on WGN. So we interviewed him, and I don't know if you heard that, but we've cut it down to about 5 minutes, the questions that you may have about this thing called MoviePass. MoviePass enables you to go see as many movies as you want as a month, and it's a $9.95 a month subscription. He said hello to us in the 10 o'clock hour on Saturday morning.
Hi, John.
You're on WGN Radio in Chicago, just so you know, because I'm sure every phone call for you is a different city and a different show going, wait a minute, you're doing what?
A little bit like that, yeah.
So if I subscribe to MoviePass for $9.95 a month, I'll get a MasterCard in the mail, and then I take that to the movie theater, and I'll purchase my movie ticket with that card the way I might my own debit or MasterCard, and it will pay for the movie from the funds in that card. But I only have to fund that card to the tune of $9.95 a month, and yet I can use it for a different movie every single day of the year at the theater, right?
That's right. It's kind of like going back to college when your parents gave you a credit card and they paid the bill, but you got to use it.
So you are losing and will lose money on this proposition then, right?
What we're doing is we're re-engaging people who wanted to go to the movies more often, and there are all kinds of ways that we can make money over time, whether it's advertising or selling you things. So it really, you know, by getting people to go back to the movie theaters, the theaters make more money, the studios make more money, and ultimately we will ask them for a small piece of the incremental profit.
Yeah, you're that light coming at the end of the tunnel. I mean, because as I understand it, you are, in fact, paying the full movie price. So if I went 30 times to the movie theater there and it cost $15 each time, that'd be $450 that you had to pay to get me into the movie theater, and I only paid you $10 for that privilege. So you're upside down $440 on me, potentially, this month alone.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And meanwhile, you have doubled the amount of money you've spent buying popcorn and soda at 80% margins for the theater.
Right, the theaters, I don't understand. They're upset about this. I'm like, no, you're getting full price, and per capita, as you point out, your consumers tend to spend more at the concession stand, maybe because they've got more discretionary money as a result. So it would
So then
how are you going to turn this beast? I mean, they're like, okay, but we still don't like it. This just looks too suspicious.
Yeah.
So what are you going to eventually do to the theaters that they don't like?
I think it's any time you introduce a new concept where you get in between the customer and the business. The business is a little concerned. You know, it's the same thing with Orbitz or Expedia. Hotels and airlines would love you just to come directly to their airline or their hotel. In the end, we're going to drive more business to them. And I think what it is right now is no one believes it. Our job is to prove that we can be a healthy part of the ecosystem.
The great convenience of this is that you can use it at any theater. It's not a theater participation card. It's a MasterCard with value. So they do or do have to take it. They may try and fight that, but that's where the law on that is right now. So here's what, though, they must fear, though, that then you're going to take the million plus subscribers you have, and now you're going to say to AMC, we don't want our people to pay $15. We want our club members to pay $9 or $11 to go to the movie, and and they are threatened by that giant voting block you'll represent.
You know, look at it this way. We are, every single subscriber who joins MoviePass goes to the movies twice as often as they did before MoviePass.
Yeah.
So when they're going twice as often and MoviePass asks for only 20%, you're better off as a theater. You're getting double the revenue, and you're giving up 20%. And yes, we will ask ultimately for 20%, but we're doubling your business. That it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that that's better for your business. 75% of our subscribers are millennials. Over the last 4 years alone, that group has decreased their amount of movie going in the theater by 20%. That's the group we're re-energizing.
I can understand how the AMC wants to be the master of its own destiny. They don't need you to tell them how they're going to be better off. So I see this sort of antagonistic dynamic that you represent, even if you don't mean to be that. You're representing your customers. Are you going to charge your customers more then? Is it I'm like, I better get in on that card for $10 now, because I'll bet you he's going to charge 15 or 20 for it down the road. What's the price strategy for the card?
Yeah, our price strategy is to figure out other ways to make money. When you walk out of the theater, we may tell you about a great restaurant across the street. We may tell you, hey, you could buy the digital soundtrack of that film. We might advertise various products to you. People are using MoviePass to de-risk seeing films. It's kind of like movie insurance. You know, they use it to go to the smaller films that they might not have been totally sold on. And the beauty of it is they can walk out and trash it to their friends later and not feel like they wasted $10, you know,
exactly.
Or $15, whatever the cost is.
MoviePass.com. There's your free commercial, my friend, but why not pass that along to listeners if they're so interested? How much money are you guys out on this whole shebang right now?
Our parent company is prepared to put $150 to $200 million into building our ecosystem and our subscriber base.
I want to make sure I'm clear on this. I can't use it for snacks or concessions. I cannot use it on 3D or IMAX movies, because that's just too expensive for you to cover that cost. And if I use it on my ticket, I can't then buy a ticket for my wife. She'll need her own separate card. Is that right?
That's right. But, you know, we are rolling out all kinds of new features. Eventually, you'll be able to add your wife to the account and get a small bill at the end of the month. We will add.
Yeah, it just ended right there. I don't know why it ended there, but that's the thrust of it. Their business plan is going to change. I mean, at some point, they're going to have to start making money. They are committing $200 million to this proposition. $200 million.
But it sounds like they're going to make money off of the movie theaters, the businesses in the area, and advertisement, not from the consumer of the product.
Yeah, but it didn't sound like you knew exactly how they were going to do that. Like, if I'm going to put $200 million into something, I really want to make sure I know how we're going to get our money back. So how are we going to do that again?
I think he probably knows. He just didn't want to tell you.
Yeah, maybe not. You're probably right, Violetta. I mean, I sure hope so. But here's something else, because, you know, I suggested if I win every day of the month, 30 days at $15, that's 30 times 15, that's $450. It cost me $10, so he's upside down $440. He said, you know what happens? Their experience, because they've been around long enough now to know a little bit about how people react with a MoviePass card. He said it's like a buffet. At first, you go a lot. You're up there eating more food than you really want, but you can't believe it's free, so you just keep getting more and more food on your plate. And then you really don't want that much. He said, in fact, rather than going to the movie every day of the month, people tend to go about twice as often as they used to go. If you used to see a movie every month or so, you'll now see two movies every month or so. Just because a movie is a real deal doesn't mean you're going to want to go see it if you don't want to go see that movie. I mean, your time means something to you, right? So he said, so I'm thinking that there, if people use it every day of the month, they'd be screwed. But they know that people are only going to use it an extra time or two. So their out-of-pocket isn't as much as it would sound. And so, yeah, now they're going to use some of these other models, like get it from other businesses or sell advertising on their page, and somehow or another they'll recoup the loss. But they've already got 1 million people signed up for it. They got 1 million faster than Netflix did. They got 1 million faster than a bunch of other well-known companies or entities that we're all interacting with. Think about this. We talked about this with him over the weekend, too. You go to a White Sox game, there's 20,000, 30,000 empty seats, depending on who they're playing, right? And haven't you always thought, shoot, they ought to give those tickets away and just sell the people that are taking the seats soda and beer? I mean, you'd be buying snacks. Or charge, instead of $15 or $20 to see the baseball game, charge $2. And, you know, and he said the problem with that is then you devalue the product. Then no one will ever pay the full face value because you're literally giving it away.
It's not worth anything at that point.
Yeah, you've literally said that. We'll give it to you for nothing. And all we are now is a beer vendor. We're not a baseball game. So that's a problem. But I that's one that I've often thought, boy, they ought to figure out a way to solve that. You go to a Bulls game or a Sox game, you know. Heck, even if the Cubs or the Blackhawks have some empty seats, they don't much. But, I mean, to me, every empty seat is a lost opportunity to sell concessions. People at Cubs games and Blackhawks games, good grief, they buy this stuff. I suppose it's that way with Bears and Bulls and White Sox, too. If I saw that many empty seats at Sox Park, I'd be thinking, I don't know how we're going to do this. Let's get buses and drive them through neighborhoods and say, hey, we're going to the ballpark. If you get on the bus, well, I will drop you off in the section of your choice.
Well, I think that that's probably, if you can't fill the seats in general, you know you have a problem. But giving it away might not be the solution.
I guess. You must absolutely be right, because they sure don't do that. John, I subscribe to MoviePass and need help. It's super hard to reach customer service. I believe that. I went on there. Listen, I clicked around over the weekend and on Friday of last week about this. And some people absolutely have problems using the cards. And good luck getting an operator on standby who will say, oh, well, here, let's fix that for you. Click, click, click. But I'll also tell you what I told Steve Bertrand at the beginning of the show. I follow Jimmy Greenfield on Twitter here in Chicago. And he went to see, I think, Shape of Water. And he said, went to see Shape of Water, used MoviePass, asked the person selling me the ticket how many people have used that. And the guy said the last 20 customers all had MoviePass at his showing. So evidently it's working for some people. I don't have the card, but I'm thinking about getting it.
You watch a lot of movies. I think you should get it.
I'm out. Absolutely. I mean, I see more than one movie a month. If you see one movie a month, you'll make... This is not an extended commercial for them, but what the heck?
I don't even remember the last movie I saw in a movie theater.
Oh, really?
But that's why he was saying it. I think movie theaters are a dying breed for millennials.
Absolutely. And I don't know why that is. The money?
Because you can... No, because you can get the experience at home, first of all.
Or, oh, no, you cannot!
Yes, you can.
You cannot get
you
the experience.
But you have streaming capabilities to buy or rent or watch...
It's not the same, though, and they've developed these movie theaters with the reclining chairs.
Yeah.
And they're turning it into your living room, and it's a huge screen. It's a way for you to get out of your house.
Once in a while, but as often as John goes.
Well, yeah, once in a while. And, I mean, this is an activity that my mom is so passionate about. And
how about you?
And, yeah, when it comes to hanging out with my mom, that's one of our favorite things to do together is go to the movies.
So you do go to the movie theater?
Yeah.
With your mom, more as a social experience. But Dunkirk, right? Everybody's all about Dunkirk this year. That's a big screen thing. If you are watching Dunkirk on something smaller than a suitcase, you're getting it wrong.
It's not the same.
It cannot be the same thing.
But next time you talk to a movie director, I wonder if movies are being filmed differently now.
That's a good question.
Because they're making them for streaming.
They must be. I mean, I would. I mean, how can you ignore that? People are watching it. People are watching them on their phones, for crying out loud.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Here we go now. In the rapidly cooling studios on Michigan Avenue, this is John. Earlier on the show,
what are you down to?
Let me see. We have a thermometer here in the studio. It's down to 87. It was 98 degrees in the studio a little while ago. I don't know why. And the great thing about me is I'm not a complainer. You would never have known that if you weren't able to kind of pull it out of me. But it was 98 and 99 degrees in here. Literally, I took a picture of the thermometer and sent it to my wife so that she would know what an American hero I am. And now it's down to 87, so it's not so bad.
Really? 87 is not so bad?
His face was bright red.
I was down there.
10 degrees cooler than it was.
I think it was 89 when I left.
The cooler air is coming in now. Whatever needs to happen to make it better is now happening.
And you're wearing a very heavy sweater.
Well, it is January, and it has been cold. Boy, did you just love the warmer temperatures on Sunday? Holy cow.
It was like a whole new world.
Oh, I know. I thought, this is what it's like to go outside and not hate it. Hate it. So much better.
50 degrees on Wednesday.
55-0.
They're saying 53, actually.
Woohoo.
Well, one thing's for sure. It was raining a little bit yesterday afternoon.
Wait a minute. Thursday.
And the very fact that I was getting some water on my car was slowly washing the salt grime off the side of my car. I didn't want to stand in line at the car wash, and I'd already turned off my outside valve to... My car is this rolling, ugly salt lick. I was at the gas station, and I got the thing that you used to clean the window with, and I started to wash the back of my car, which is a... That's not going to get it done. I was actually just pushing the mud around now. But it was it was so nice to have it just a little bit warmer yesterday and today and this week. Sam Panayotovich joins us from WGN Radio Sports. He talks to us on Saturdays and helps us out at other times of the week, too. Hey, Sam, how are you?
I am good, John.
You taking your dad to the airport later today? Is that the word?
Yeah. I was going to try and come in. You know, I wanted to celebrate the new Bears head coach, but... playing Tetris with my car back forth did not sound like a great idea. So I'm mobile again.
I appreciate you joining us now. So celebrate. Are you happy about this? Was this a really good choice for us?
Well, a couple things. I think first and foremost, I like that Ryan Pace attacks fast, no matter what it is. When he gets the guy he wants, he goes for it. In the NFL draft, he traded up. Granted, it was a couple extra picks, but he traded up and drafted Mitch Trubisky. I like the aggressiveness there. He goes through six candidates in the head coaching search. It took about 5 days. He didn't wait long. I mean, on Monday, he decided this is the new head coach. So he doesn't sit around and wait. He goes out and gets who he wants. Now, I thought Pat Shurmur was the best candidate, the offensive coordinator for Minnesota, because he's been around the block. He's an older guy. I think he can build the best staff, because a lot of times with the head coach, it's about who can build the best staff. And I think that was the knock on the Eagles quarterback coach, John DeFilippo, who was very vivacious, very flashy. You know, he's got the sneaker collection. He's outspoken, but he's younger. And I don't know if he could put together a really good staff. Matt Nagy, on the other hand, who is the coach, and it's Nagy. I think he comes from one of the best coaching trees in the history of the NFL. The Andy Reid coaching tree is so strong. You look at John Harbaugh, Leslie Frazier, Ron Rivera, Doug Peterson. The list is pretty extensive, and it's pretty strong. So I like Nagy. I think he did really good things with their offense when he took over. Last four games of the year, they averaged 8 yards per play. He's creative. He's a go-getter, and he lives and dies in the film room. So it's a good move. I like it.
What kind of offense? How would we notice the Bears under him? What would it be like on the field?
Well, he used a lot of double running back sets. He used a lot of tight ends. You know, Travis Kelce, one of the better tight ends in football, really ran wild in this offense for Kansas City. So that's good for the young rookie, Adam Shaheen. Jordan Howard, Tariq Cohen, getting them out in space, getting Tariq Cohen, you know, creative little looks and having him do things that maybe John Fox and Dal Loggins didn't do. I think it's just the unpredictability of it, because Dal Loggins was not very creative. And other defensive coordinators and other defensive players often said after games, we knew knew exactly what they were going to do, so it wasn't tough to stop. I think with Nagy, you're going to see a guy who kind of throws out the kitchen sink and does things that a lot of people aren't really doing. It's about how he moves the chess pieces around the board. He does things that a lot of people just haven't done. And how about this? Andy Reid has been around a long time as a head coach, I think since the late 90s. He never once relinquished his play-calling duties until he met Matt Nagy. So this is the first guy in over 17 years to actually get the keys of the car to an offense for Andy Reid. That says a lot, doesn't it?
So we'll still have the same players, essentially. I mean, whatever we get in the draft and so on and so forth, but it's still those guys. Will he be able to turn those guys around?
Well, he'll get more out of these guys that he has, but you're totally right. Now the pressure goes on Ryan Pace. There's a lot of money to spend. The Bears have quite a bit of change in the kitty. Go out and spend some money. Go out and pay a wide receiver. Make some trades. Allocate your talents in the draft because you have to – you fix the coaching side of things. We knew John Fox had to go. We knew they needed some young blood and some fresh eyes and some better concepts. Now you need to address what's actually inside the cupboard. So you're right. You have to go out and make some moves. I think they're going to be aggressive in the free agent market, not that you usually strike gold in free agency because you're paying a premium for guys on the open market, but you need wide receivers. You probably need another offensive lineman, but I think it all starts with the quarterback. And if you look at what Philadelphia did with Carson Wentz, the jump from year one to year two, they go from out of the playoffs to the number one seed in the NFC. You look at the Rams in Los Angeles. They get rid of Jeff Fisher. They bring in Sean McVay. Jared Goff, a monumental rise from year one to year two. So everything coincides with three things: your GM, your head coach, and your quarterback. And these guys are all on the same page. And I'm not saying the Bears are going to make the playoffs next year, but I expect them to make a definite jump. I think they're going to be around 8-9 wins next year, and then you go from there. But you have to make moves to fix this roster. You have to hike it up and get some guys in there that can make differences.
So the Bears next year are 8-10, or is it 8-8? How many games do they play in the regular season?
Yeah, 16. I think eight is fair. You know, 9 is not crazy. You know, that wild card spot, usually teams with 9 wins are right there in the conversation. Of course, you have to contend with the Packers, who will be back because Aaron Rodgers, I imagine, will be healthy. Minnesota and their defense not going anywhere. So it's going to be one of the better divisions in football. You still have to beat the teams in your division, and that's what John Fox just couldn't do. He couldn't beat the Packers, couldn't beat the Vikings, couldn't beat the Lions, and that's why we are where we are today.
National Championship college football game tonight pits number 3 Georgia and number 4 Alabama. It'll be on ESPN at 7 o'clock. 25 wins and 2 losses between these two teams. Should I make a point to watch this game? Is this really going to be a great one like maybe the preliminary game was, or should I not watch it?
I would watch it. I don't think it's going to top the double overtime shootout between Georgia and Oklahoma, but I think this is really a chance to change the guard in college football. Steve even brought it up in the sportscast when he was doing the news that, you know, it's always easy to pick Alabama, and of course it is. They've won 4 national championships in the last 8 years, and Nick Saban against his former assistants is 11-0. A former assistant has never beat Nick Saban. Kirby Smart is a former Nick Saban assistant. So everything says you should pick Alabama, but John, Georgia has Goober McGoober.
Goober McGoober is the field goal kicker for Georgia. He's got a 1970s porn stash, and he wears really thick black glasses underneath there. He looks like the kind of guy who they said, all right, somebody get him a helmet, he can be on the team. But he's not really on the team. He's their field goal kicker, and that kid can kick.
And he's being trained by Kevin Butler, former Bears kicker, who a lot of people really liked here in Chicago. His real name is Rodrigo Blankenship, by the way. You and I have talked about Goober McGoober for weeks, and people always text in, wait, I'm Googling Goober McGoober, and I can't find anything. I do think, look, Alabama is the cream of the crop. And Nick Saban, you know, say what you want about Nick Saban's record this year and what he's done. You know, the big loss to Auburn, he's always going to be dangerous. But I do think the short turnaround is in favor of Georgia. I like the running backs. They've got 2 guys, Sony Michel and Nick Chubb. This freshman quarterback is a stud. I know it's a freshman quarterback against Alabama, but this is not the deepest Alabama team by any means. And they're banged up at linebacker. Their best secondary player is a little bit messed up. He hurt his kidney last week. Their quarterback, I'm not a big fan of. So while sure, it's Alabama in name, I really do like what Georgia's done this year. I think they were the best team all season long in the SEC. They only have 1 loss. They lost at Notre Dame by a point, or they actually beat Notre Dame by a point. They only had 1 loss. That was against Auburn. So I think Georgia, I think it's the pick, not just because of Goober McGooberson or whatever we're calling them, but I like their offense, and I think they're better than a lot of people think. So I think Georgia's going to pull the upset here.
Anything else I should ask you about in the world of sports? Those are the 2 big stories in Chicago and the country today.
Well, you know, I think that's plenty of to get to. You know, you got the NFL, the Bears make a change of coach, and the national championship is fine. There's really not much else. The Bulls might trade your guy, Nico Mirotic. I think that's inevitable. Mm-hmm. They can actually deal him in the next week or so, and we know the plan on the west side of Chicago. It's to lose, lose, lose. So I think they're trying to drive his stock up. Maybe he has another good couple of games, and then they'll probably deal him. So the Bulls will have to find a new teammate to punch.
Well, it was fun when they were winning all those basketball games, and now they're kind of back and forth, back and forth. They are absolutely better since he's come back. And Zach LaVine is supposed to put on a Bulls uniform in a week, I believe, right?
Yes, and that's another reason why they're trying to get Nico out. It's not that they don't like Nico. It's not that they don't appreciate what he's done, but you're trying to see what Zach LaVine can do, and you want to take off the restrictor plates, the governors. You want to see what Zach LaVine can do. He's going to be your alpha. He's your 1A player. There's no reason for him to share shots with Nico. You're not going to win anyways. You're not going to go to the playoffs and win, so you might as well bottom out while you can. I think if you trade Mirotić, you maybe get a draft pick or something back, and then you see what you got with Zach LaVine. That's the plan.
I don't think we're going to see LaVine shoot it the way Mirotić did when he came off the injured list, but when he finds his stroke, it's good. But the reason you're going to love Zach LaVine is because he can jump out of the gym. He can really make some exciting things happen.
That's 100% correct. I don't think the Bulls have one player who lives above the rim, and they haven't really had one since before Derrick Rose got hurt. So he's exciting. He's won dunk contests. He can fly, man. I mean, this guy can jump from the free throw line and dunk. He can catch alley-oops. He's a high flyer, a fast riser. He's going to be fun to watch. Team's not going to win a lot of games, but you're trying to build blocks and find guys going forward, and that's what they're trying to do.
Drive safely, my friend, and I will talk to you on Saturday, if not sooner. Thank you, Sam.
Always fun. See ya.
Hey Sam. Sam,
yeah.
I wanted to know more about the world of sports and maybe betting, what would be a good podcast for me to listen to?
Oh, I'm glad you found that $10 bill in your back pocket. Yeah, you can find Chicken Dinner. Chicken Dinner is on iTunes. It's on Stitcher, Google Play. You can actually talk to the Amazon Echo. You could just say, hey, play Chicken Dinner podcast, and she will play it. And we actually picked Georgia before the playoffs started, so we're hoping that comes true.
If you like sports and think this guy sounds pretty good here, you should hear his podcast. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Sean.
Sam Panionovich, WGN Sports. We've had this conversation about what should we give to, say, Amazon or some major company to come to Chicago, to come to Illinois. What kind of incentives do you give them? What kind of tax breaks do you give them?
You rename the city. That's what you do.
You know, we're about ready to. Do you think that we're going to get the HQ2?
I think the odds are very hard or tall against anyone.
Right. Well,
and there are a lot of great. I mean, I think every city thinks that they probably are doing pretty well. I think we got a great case for it.
The thing that bothers me when we give the store to a company, we say, yeah, but look at all the jobs we'll get, is that what do you get with those jobs? How well paying are they? And then do we all have to pick up the slack while these billionaire companies and their high paying executives seem to enjoy the good life on the backs of all of us? There was a piece in the New York Times over the weekend, and they said that the unemployment rate in Indiana is as low as it's ever been. They were able to lure a lot of companies in there by giving them tax breaks. So now they're able to say, wow, look at this company. X, Y, and Z are all in Indiana. Hooray. And then you ask the people that work in Indiana, how's it going for you? And a lot of them are holding two jobs. A lot of them are making less than they used to make. These companies might not be paying well, but at least they're offering jobs that people have no other choice but to take. And I thought, well, that's an interesting way to look at this situation. The woman who had the piece in the New York Times was Farrah Stockman, and she'd actually written about one company in particular, and I believe it was Indianapolis, and she went back to visit that company and then wrote about it. I reached out to her. Well, in fact, we just found her. Hey, Farrah, it's John Williams. How are you?
Good. Can you hear me?
I can. Am I saying your name correctly, too? Is it Farrah or Farrah?
It's Farrah.
Farrah Stockman. Do you write about the business scene? Is that your beat at the New York Times?
That's a mystery. My beat is a mystery. I was more of a political reporter, to be honest, than a business reporter, but I've learned an awful lot about business because I've been following Rex Nord for about not quite a year, but following these steel workers at a plant that announced that it was moving to Mexico right before the election last year.
So you started reporting on Rexnord, R-E-X-N-O-R-D. They make bearings in Indianapolis. And so you've kind of gotten to know some of these people, or at least this company's story, huh?
Yeah, and I think it's really important because we can make a lot of generalizations about what people think, people, you know, why the political situation is the way it is and polarization. But then you go on the ground, they're real people. They have, they're not cartoons, and they have, you know, nuanced views of the world. And, you know, you can sort of talk to them and try to understand how what they've been going through.
Did you look at this, though, through the lens of people who voted for the president, and now what's the consequence of that?
A bit. So the factory was about 40% black and about 60% white, and a lot of the white people voted for Trump. I couldn't find a single black person who voted for Trump. But here they are working side by side. They have bowling league. They date interracially. They go out to dinner together. They go to Colts games together. Like, you know, they love each other. But how can you have such a striking difference in how people were forming their political worldview? I was interested in that. And, it, you know, the factory was kind of a microcosm of working class America. It had women working there. It had people who'd been working there all their adult lives since the day they stepped out of high school.
What's happening to the Rexnord workers or plant in Indianapolis?
So the plant, they announced on late in October last year that they're moving to McAllen, Texas, and to Monterey, Mexico. And so the 300 workers that were working there were going to be laid off. Some of them had to, some of them decided to train their replacements, which caused a lot of friction in the plant. A lot of the friendships ended because of that. And now I'm just sort of looking at them, talking to them, and seeing what jobs they're getting. A lot of these people who were making $25 an hour are now making $15 an hour. They're working as contract deliverers of like FedEx packages, or some of them have gotten jobs at Allison, which is another, it's a factory. I think they're Teamsters. It's another union shop, but it's a two-tier union shop. Yeah, so they're not in the good tier that's making the top dollar. So, and some of them haven't found jobs yet. So,
were these people told prior to the election, or maybe sometime after the election, that their jobs were more secure as a result of Donald Trump being president? I mean, talk about that a little bit.
Well, they're the same union as Carrier, and as you might know, Trump made Carrier like a big part of his rallies. He would go all around the Midwest and start talking about how Carrier was moving to Mexico. Carrier is like, they make furnaces and air conditioners, and they were also moving Indianapolis plant to Mexico. And so, you know, Trump had this, he really resonated with people. He would say, how many years have you worked at Carrier? And people call out like 28 years, 14 years, 10 years. You know, it was this, and so people who were in this union really felt like Trump was personally involved in the fight to save their job. And shortly after Trump was elected, he tweeted about Rexnord, and he said, you know, Rexnord is viciously firing all 300 of its workers, no more. And these workers sat around their union hall debating for hours, like, what does that mean? No more. Does it mean no more after Rexnord, or does it mean he's going to stop Rexnord? So there were guys who wrote to Donald Trump every day for like 6 months asking him to save the job. And many people, you know, really believed that he would.
That's fascinating and sad, but I don't know that there's anything that even this president could do to save their jobs. Per se, do you think that the jobs were going to go to Mexico and Texas regardless of who won the election? I mean, it's just an economic reality.
Well, so I have two ways of answering that question, because I think more stuff did go to Texas than, because the company is hedging its bets. They're afraid of a tariff, so they built up this factory in Texas. But guess what? The jobs in Texas really suck. They are paying like $10 an hour to work in a non-air-conditioned, super hot place. And, you know, they're all temps. They're all brought in as temps. It's very different than a middle class union job that was in Indianapolis. So I think Donald Trump hit a real point when he started talking about jobs, because that's something that I think both parties have kind of thrown up their hands and said, this is just economic reality. These jobs just got to go. And, you know, Democrats used to have this solid union support. All of these workers I talked to came from families that used to vote solidly Democrat because they thought the Democratic Party was looking out for unions. But as unions have lost power and membership, you know, Democrats haven't been looking out for unions in the same way. And so I think we saw the result in the election.
And so then you wrote about, well, then what has, so now Indiana can brag about having swell companies. Illinois would be happy to have some of them, but these new jobs don't pay so well. So some of the people are struggling or working two jobs and struggling. Talk a little bit about that, the reality for workers in Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Indiana's tried really hard to be a business-friendly state, and they have a reputation as being a business-friendly state, but the result is also that people aren't able to make ends meet with a job or even two jobs. And so I think we really have to ask ourselves as a country, what does it mean to go all in for these companies without caring, without having any standards about the way they treat their workers? I think that's a really important question that people don't ask, and they should ask when they fight. You know, there are bidding wars over companies.
Oh, Lord, it's amazing. When I get to be king, Farah, here's what I'm going to do. It'll be a big story. It'll be in all the papers. When I get to be king, I'm going to say, okay, we'll still give you incentives. Like, we'll build your roads, and we'll train the workers, and we'll give you corporate tax breaks. But we're going to increase the minimum wage in our state so that then you have to pay the workers. Because otherwise, you know, these people are on the public dole then. Some of them are on assistance while they're working for these companies. So we're sort of paying welfare for the companies.
It's true. And if you look at the number of people who work at Walmart that get public assistance, that get food stamps, and they have jobs at Walmart, why do they have to be on food stamps? And yet, like, something like 6 out of the top 10 richest people in America are from the Walton family that owns Walmart. We've created a system, a tax system, that makes it possible to basically subsidize places like Walmart. And I think we have to be really honest with ourselves about what the economy looks like for people, because in the next 10 years and 20 years, we're going to see a lot more jobs be outsourced or be done by a machine. And people, that's not their fault.
I was just about to quote you to you in your paper where you're in the article in the New York Times Sunday. It's on page 2, as I recall. And it was Miss Warnell, you referred to a researcher previously at Ball State University, suggests that no matter how painful these disruptions have been to American workers over the last few decades, they are likely to look small compared to what's to come. And then you talk about a guy who works at a company called Makuta, and he makes plastic parts. Stu, how many parts do you make in a year, I asked. Between 150 and 200 million, he replied. How many people do you employ, you asked? And he said, 10. Oh, God, that just kicked me right in the gut when I read that.
Emily Warnell has looked at counties, every single county in the United States, and she's done that to analyze how many jobs are likely to be outsourced or automated. And she said there are counties in the United States where 2/3 of the jobs are going to be outsourced or automated in the next 10 years. And, you know, our schools aren't getting kids ready for the reality of what that looks like. Our companies aren't ready for the reality of what it looks like. And our political system isn't ready for it, because our political system is going in the opposite direction. It's saying we don't need social safety nets. We don't need to think about taking care of people who don't have jobs, because we're going to give a lot of tax breaks so that companies can create jobs. And I think there's, you know, I don't believe either party has all the answers.
Yeah.
But we have to be really honest about the pace of change. What's different about what's happening now is the change, technological change, is going so fast that there's no way a kid in college right now can be sure that they're studying something that is going to still exist. Well,
and that's
in
the kid in and that's the kid in college, by the way. I mean, right. What about those who are not? They don't have the aptitude, the money, or the inclination. In the past, there was something for them. We're counting. I know you know this, but I just want to hear it on my radio show. We're counting jobs these days, but not dollars. That's what we need to do now. Okay, unemployment is where we want it to be. Hooray! And 401ks, if you are in the minority and have one, lucky you. But in the meantime, people still have to go to work and get a job, and those new jobs just aren't paying that much anymore.
I have a friend who's a really wealthy hedge fund guy, and he's super smart, and he's a philanthropist. He's a good guy. But I asked him about this, and he said, well, you know, maybe our society is going to look more like Downton Abbey. You know, maybe all the jobs that are going to come up are going to be service jobs, servicing the wealthy, like dog walkers or personal trainers, or you know, there's going to be new jobs that we hadn't thought about before, but they're going to be servicing the very wealthy people that are making money because they own all the machines that are automating, or they own all the, you know, the factories that are overseas. And that just struck me, because that was okay with him. And I don't think that's okay with a lot of people. And even if you're a dog walker, what's your pension going to be? Where are you going to get your health care? I think that we have to, if that's the society we're going to have, let's have a system for those people to be able to retire and to be able to have health care, which we don't now.
Well, on the great experiment that we've decided we want to engage in right now as well, here's what's going to happen. We're going to give businesses and wealthy people breaks, and then they're going to have more money, and then they're going to create things or jobs for the rest of us, and hopefully those will pay us all well enough that we'll be glad we made that deal.
Sure.
I hope that works. I hope that works.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no reason to root against it, but if it doesn't, shame on us. All my phone lines are ringing, Farrah. I'm sure that shocks you. Her piece in the Sunday New York Times, Farrah Stockman, is looking at blue-collar factory jobs in the rearview mirror. It's the story of Rexnord, among others, in Indianapolis. They make ball bearings there, but those jobs are moving to Texas and Mexico. Can I just take a couple real quick questions with you, Farrah?
Sure.
You got to get going, don't you, Farrah?
I can do a couple.
I'll be done with you in 3 minutes, literally. Let's start with Rob. Bob, you're on WGN. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Sarah, I remember distinctly him going down there, the dog and pony show that Trump and Pence went through, telling these people they were going to save their jobs. And it is infuriating to me that they're left as waste now. He doesn't even think about them. Why doesn't he go down there now and talk to these people? He knew exactly what was going to happen. They weren't even president or vice president at the time. They were doing a victory lap, and they used those people. And it boils my blood, because they all believed him, and they all fell in line. And he sat there, and he used them like he's used every other contractor he's never paid and other people that he's used. And my God, if we don't rise up against this kind of thing, I cannot tell you, when I think about him going down there, how mad it makes me that these people are all losing their jobs now. And he knew, and Pence knew. Pence used a little favor, and they threw him $1 million tax break, yeah, you know, to all of a sudden put
okay,
on
Bob.
A show for 6 months.
Hey, Bobby, I feel your passion, and I'm really glad you called. The president still gets big crowds, though, at his rallies, Farrah.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't sound like your question, but I will say there's some people who feel that way, the way that the caller just felt. There's others who say, hey, at least Trump raised our issue. At least he talked about workers and jobs and keeping things made in America, where Hillary didn't talk about that enough. And so I think there's, you know, these people are not a monolith. They have a lot of different views among them. Some of them really say, hey, at least he talked about us and got us on the agenda. But I will say there's disappointment in the fact that the VAT tax, they talked about a border tax, stuff like that. It just never went anywhere. The Trump tax plan was far away from that, because the Walmarts of the world and the retailers don't want it. And so we didn't get a VAT tax, which would have made life easier for manufacturers in the United States.
Reed Farris Stockman in yesterday's New York Times, and in the future, for that matter, looking at blue-collar factory jobs in the rearview mirror. I really appreciate your time today, Farris. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Well done. At least it makes you think about that. It's and that's a lot of fun. It's 254 here on WGN Radio. What is the outside temperature? Steve just got up. Judy's about to sit in. Do you have it in front of you over there, Violetta? Do you see the current temperature outside? I could probably pull it up myself here.
Yeah, you know what? Let me see. I think it's about
36 degrees.
That's what I was going to say. Mostly sunny.
Yeah. 52, though maybe rainy. Rainy. On Thursday, 52 degrees.
Should we go to the beach?
Have you been to the beach? Have you been to Lake Michigan lately? Oh, my God. Now, maybe some of those scenes are melting, but oh, my God, has Lake Michigan just looked eerie and fantastic? And to literally watch it sort of throb with the waves under the ice. And the ice is all kind of broken up. And then on the shore where it was freezing, it just made all of these weird shapes. It's really a thing of beauty.
Seeing the ice on the rocks.
Oh, yeah.
The way that they freeze on there.
It's just really been spectacular. The problem is you'll die looking at it because it's so dang cold. Now it's a little bit warmer, so maybe now's the time to run over to somewhere on the lake and take pictures before those scenes all go away, because they really have been special.
I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you. But the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning.
Doesn't that sound to you like Reagan meets Obama? Didn't that strike you as a political speech? That was her launch last night.
I didn't think she intended it that way, but you can't deny that she crystallized the moment and
what a great
brought
speech.
A lot of people to tears.
Oh my!
I was even shocked by it because been around the Oprah a long time, and I just didn't.
You didn't love that speech.
Well, I kind of get, you know, she's an amazing performer, and she's always been a great performer.
That was heartfelt, Ro.
I think the greatest performers make those things heartfelt, and I think that, and even she moved. I gotten used to not being moved by her because at the end, like that last season, especially. There was a lot of.
I was at the United Center for her last show. Just so you know, I think.
Humble
cards.
Brag.
No, but I mean, so I drink the Oprah tea Kool-Aid a little.
It'll
anyway.
Be the tea. The Teavana is what you drink.
It's the chai Teavana.
Yeah,
it's the Oprah version.
But the thing is that she. last night, I truly believed. I believed in her last night.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, I did, and I get that, you know, some of it is just made for television with her.
But did you find it was amazing? Because you kind of make fun of how she does that new car. Everyone's getting there. Everyone
did get into that.
The audience reacted as if she had said that, and what she said was a new day. And she got people on their feet.
Right,
legitimately.
She did. And very few people who simultaneously want to make a speech like that and also sell you poop pills doesn't always go together. And in this case, it did. And I think this is a new moment finally, I think what America was really looking for there, and I know we're going to get to the news here in a second, but what America is really looking for right now is some coalescence and some hope that it isn't just going to be us versus them. No matter who your us is and who your them is, we're living in a world that is in which we're being retrained into they're the bad guy, we're the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And America has to make a choice about everything, even about their pastimes. They have to make a choice.
Yeah, it's funny.
And and to have somebody sort of put the Band-Aid over that in a very maternal way and say, This is about what brings us together, not what divides us. I thought was incredibly powerful. And yes, and that story she told about being on the linoleum floor.
Oh, my God.
Because that's
what.
Tears.
What I, you know, like everybody, you know, of a certain age remembers that, like, you know, a little TV in the room and being on the kitchen floor or whatever it is. And it's kind of a universal
thing.
Who
in America could have delivered that speech that well last night?
It's
at that moment, the
probably
right
nobody.
Person.
Right.
By the way, Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, I like to think of them as stable and genius, are in the studio. We'll let you decide which one is which.
Stabler, yeah, geniuses, yeah. You'll never
I know,
find.
Actually, you're no dummy, and you're relatively stable. But
No.
Unstable genius? Is that okay?
Unstable half-wit is basically what I've been called by many members of my family.
Have a good
so
show.
There you go. Thank you.